I'm David Lazarus, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of June 20th, 2014. This week, have you received a call or an email from the IRS? Did they say there's a problem with your tax return? Spoiler alert, it wasn't really the IRS, and they're not really trying to help you. Also, we're going to show you how you can pay down your debt even when it seems hopeless. But first, you go to the doctor. You expect to pay a doctor's fee. Maybe you'll pay for some medicine, maybe some blood work, an x-ray. But hello, what's this? It's a facility fee or a procedure fee. And if your doctor or hospital aren't in your insurance provider's network, you're looking at even more fees. Here to help us navigate the minefield of medical bills is Emily Bazar. She's a healthcare journalist and the author of a Q&A column on Obamacare called Ask Emily, which runs in newspapers across California. Hiya, Emily.
Hi, David.
All right, so let's look at healthcare billing. And this is interesting to me because I had a column in the LA Times the other day about a woman who went in for injections of a pain medication for her knee. And she had to pay a couple hundred bucks to the doctor. She had to pay a lot for the medication. And then she looked at her bill and found that there was an over $500 charge that she couldn't explain and that the hospital had a hard time explaining too, calling it various things until it finally settled on procedure fee. And this woman was flummoxed, of course. How common is this?
David, it's very common. And this is not necessarily new. This kind of, I noticed that somebody in your column called this situation with the difficulties in billing Orwellian. I like to call it Kafkaesque. You know, we can call it whatever we want. It's very complicated. And it's gotten worse in some ways since the Affordable Care Act went into effect on January 1st.
A lot of hospitals defend these fees as saying, well, they need to cover the overhead of the treatment room or the operating room. In some cases, there's something called cost shifting, where they're basically trying to get insured people to pay for uninsured people. And then on top of that, there's the whole question of whether your doctor is in an insurer's network or not. And if you're a patient, should that even be a thing, knowing whether it's in network?
In this age of Obamacare, whether your doctor or hospital is in network is extremely important. You've always had to know, especially if you had a PPO or an EPO plan, whether your doctor or hospital was in network. That was always important. But it's gained even more importance since January 1st, since the Affordable Care Act went into effect. Lawmakers and health policy folks were cheering about how now there's these $6,400 out-of-pocket maximums for individual plans and $12,700 for family plans. And those figures on their own sound like a lot to me as they are. But what people are finding out now as they're using their plans, they're trying to access health care, is that they're may not even be maximums on their use of out-of-network providers. So a woman from Berkeley emailed me to say, you know, I just found out that my EPO plan does not even have an out-of-pocket maximum for out-of-network use. Why is this a big deal? You may be saying, okay, or your listeners may be saying, you know, okay, big deal. Just stay in network. That's easier said than done these days. And that's because plans have basically hacked down their networks and they have significantly limited the number of doctors and hospitals that participate in these plans. Add to that that it's really, really hard to find out whether your doctor or your hospital participates in these plans. The California Medical Association, which represents about 40,000 doctors in California, did a survey recently, and they found that 4 out of 5 doctors, about 2,300 doctors responded recently, 4 out of 5 of them said that they were confused at some point about their status as network providers in covered California plans. That was at some point. Now, you know, what are we in June? 6 months into this, 1 out of 5 is still confused.
But this gets even goofier because your doctor might be in network, but the hospital that he or she is working out of might not be.
Exactly. And, you know, I called Blue Shield and I said, hey, I've got people writing to me saying that they need to get a procedure and at the hospital and that their doctor is in network, but that the only hospital at which their doctor has privileges is not in network. So that leaves them in a very, very difficult position. They have two choices, basically. Either they say, oh, I want my doctor to do this procedure, but that'll cost them tens of thousands of dollars. Or they do something which I know most people don't want to do, which is they'll have to switch doctors to someone who has privileges at a hospital that's in network.
And so now people get that five-figure bill or that six-figure bill, their jaw falls open, and then they wonder, what do you do about it? So let me put it to you. What do you do about it when you get a bill that you want to dispute, you want to somehow bring it down to a reasonable level? Are there ways to do that?
Yes, there's hopefully there may be. There's several things you should do. The first step you should take is to immediately call your health plan. And you call the number that's on your health insurance card and you dispute the bill. Now, you may not get the resolution you want out of that. So the next step to take if you don't get a good answer is to file a grievance or an appeal directly with your health plan. And you have pretty much at least 180 days to do that. So I would say, you should definitely do that and do it within 180 days.
What about contacting the hospital directly and saying, Jiminy Crickets, this much for an MRI? Will that get you anywhere?
When you have a health plan, your financial contract is with the health insurer. So you contract with the insurer, and the insurer contracts with the hospitals and the doctors. So I have heard about hospitals, and I know you wrote about this, David, that hospitals have sometimes been willing to negotiate on those big, big bills. They may still be willing to, but as your own, the woman you wrote about with the knee injections, she didn't have any luck doing that.
Well, when I talk to doctors, even when I talk to hospital officials at various medical centers, they all tell me how frustrated they are with the system, and particularly with the billing system. Well, if the industry, and this is a $3 trillion industry we're talking about, is this frustrated, can we expect any changes? Can we expect greater transparency in medical billing in months or years ahead?
I hope so. I hope so. I think, I was at a panel discussion, and one thing that really struck me was that they acknowledged what a mess it is right now. I mean, maybe not saying it quite in those words, but they acknowledged how stressed the system is right now. And they basically said, what we do know, we don't know exactly what it's going to be in 5 years or even maybe even next year, but it is going to change. So Obamacare is putting pressure on this system, and it will evolve into something else. But I just can't tell you what that something else is.
My thanks, of course, to Emily Bazar. She is a healthcare journalist and author of the Q&A column on Obamacare called Ask Emily. Thank you so much, Emily.
You're welcome, David.
How much did your upbringing influence how you spend money? Maybe you had a frugal father or a spendthrift stepmom. Maybe your family experienced hard times. Maybe you never knew money troubles until you got out on your own. Every so often, we ask someone to tell us about how their family life shaped their financial life. Today, a comedian tells how she learned from her father to spend small and dream big.
My name is Carol Leifer. I'm a comedian and comedy writer, and people would probably know me from writing for Seinfeld, Saturday Night Live, The Larry Sanders Show, Modern Family, currently Devious Maids. One of my favorite subjects to talk about, other than food, is really money. Because I was raised in a Jewish family, and parents of the Depression. My dad was very, one would call it thrifty, others would call it cheap. You know, to me as a kid, to buy, drink Tropicana orange juice, that was like going to the Ritz Carlton because my folks bought frozen orange juice. You know, my dad was like, it's the same thing, Carol. It's a quarter of the price. But of course, it was like, no, Dad, it's orange clumps of goo that mix with tap water that just become bigger, oranger clumps of goo. That's disgusting. My folks were very passionate about work. I call it TGIM people. Thank God it's Monday people. But not because work was a drudge or it was because work is where you express yourself and is exciting. So my father was an optometrist and he converted our garage into an optical office so he could see patients in the evening. So he was very into it, you know. But he dreamed about being a comedian. You know, he really wanted to do that. So it's great that when I had this dream, he was very encouraging to me. I remember coming home from my junior year in college when I auditioned at a comedy club and I told my father that I had passed the audition. And the first thing my father said, besides, well, Carol, you got to strike while the iron's hot. You know, he said, Carol, stand-up is a big cash business and you can't beat cash. And you know what? Lo and behold, he was right. Son of a gun. My dad's attitude about being thrifty has really stayed with me. It's kind of in my DNA now. You know, like we have, my partner and I have an 8-year-old son, and we were in the park the other day, and they had a wishing well, and he wanted to throw a coin in the wishing well. And, you know, my partner gave him a quarter, and I, like, hit the roof, you know, like, pennies. It's pennies for wishing wells, people. So...
Want to hear other musicians, comedians, authors, and actors reflect on their childhoods and hard-learned money lessons? You can hear the entire series just by going to marketplacemoney.org, search for the words Family Finance. Up next, I'll be taking your calls and tackling your financial questions. And later on in the show, what do you do when Uncle Sam turns out to be Uncle Scam?
The IRS does not call taxpayers. I was actually targeted by scammers by phone just a couple days ago. And the person on the other end of the line says, this is the IRS and we're investigating you. You know, anytime you hear IRS and investigation, you think, well, my gosh, what have I done? And then as the person continued to talk, I thought, wait a second, this is that scam. This is the scam that I wrote about.
Beware the con artist chasing down taxpayers like you and me. Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. Now we reach the part of the show that is my favorite part of the show because it is your part of the show where we take your questions and see if we can make a little order out of things. And our first call comes from Anna in Highlands, North Carolina. Hiya, Anna.
Hey, David. How are you?
Good. So what's new in Highlands, North Carolina?
Unemployment and a house sale.
Well, okay. All of which bode transitional in life. Before I get into that, tell me a little bit about yourself. You're unemployed right now. What were you doing?
I was teaching photography.
Mm-hmm.
And I lost my job in August of last year. And my parents have a vacation house here in Highlands, and they're kind enough to share it with me. So that's how I've ended up here from Maryland.
All right, very cool about that. So what's the money trouble?
Well, I'm not making any. I have just applied to the Peace Corps, and I'm not sure what will happen with that. But regardless, I'm not likely to make a lot of money in the long term. But I am currently, my house is under contract to sell, and it was rental property. I am probably going to make about $150,000 off of that. And so I'm just trying to figure out the best way to invest it for retirement.
Okay, let me back that up just a moment. Why the Peace Corps?
Well, I still love teaching, but I'm interested in doing something that is maybe a little bit more meaningful. I mean, I love teaching photography, but I'm interested in kind of reaching out to people who are a little bit more in need.
That is so incredibly cool. Was there a particular moment where you sat back and you thought this is where you saw your life going in the near term?
There were lots of moments. It's something that I've thought about doing off and on ever since I was an undergrad, which was many years ago. And it just, you know, with coming to a point now where I'm unemployed. Actually, I've also just started meditating, so I'm sort of slowing down and rethinking things, rethinking values, and it's just sort of all coming together right now.
Any idea where you could end up going?
I'm interested in either South America, which is very broad, or Africa, again, very broad. But I think right now I'm leaning towards South America. I took a little bit of Spanish in school, and I think I could pick the language up again, and that's something that I could also potentially use for a career after the Peace Corps.
How's your Swahili?
Not so good.
It'll come.
Right.
All right, so we're looking at them. You've got this rental property, and
right.
You're figuring that you could bring in about how much from it again? About $150,000?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a good investment.
So the question then becomes, what do you do with this money and in what time frame, correct?
Right.
All right. I would say that something like this is all about your expectations of returns, which
okay.
is going to define how aggressive you want to be with any investment, and also your appetite for risk, which is going to help guide you towards what sort of investments you want to make. For example, if you didn't want a lot of risk, you'd be looking at certificates of deposit or the money market. If you wanted to take a greater risk, you'd be looking at biotech stocks or some other very volatile stock that potentially has great reward but also potentially has catastrophe. You just
okay.
don't know which way that can go. So that's a key thing. And whenever we talk about appetite for risk, the barometer for that is how well are you going to sleep at night? It's the same thing I apply to myself and my investments, and that's what you're going to want to ask yourself there. You know, when you're out there in the middle of the savannah or in the hacienda or wherever you end up, will you sleep well at night knowing your money is doing X, Y, or Z? And that's what you want to ask yourself.
Okay.
What do you think? How much risk do you want?
I tend to go middle of the road with most things in life, so I would stick with the middle of the road. I'm 45 right now, so, you know, if I were younger, I would go all out with the risk. But, you know, I'm getting closer to theoretical retirement. I don't know if I'll ever actually make it to retirement. But that said, and with a projected low future income, I guess I would say middle of the road.
How long does this Peace Corps gig last?
It's a 2-year commitment. You can sign up for another 2 years afterwards, but we'll wait and see how that happens.
Here's my advice, Anna.
Okay.
Play it conservative while you are doing this, because obviously this Peace Corps thing represents a transitional stage in your life.
Okay.
You're clearly rethinking things, and you know you're moving the furniture around in your life,
right.
And that's fine. That's all good. What you don't need is your money causing you any sorts of headaches during that process. So if it was me, I'd be looking at a relatively conservative investment, CDs, for example, or the money market, or just a nice plain vanilla index fund, something that's just going to be one of those set it and forget it investments
uh-huh.
that you don't really have to think too much about, but nevertheless will still bring in, you know, a modicum of returns. And then after you finish with this next step in your life, after you're prepared to start making decisions about where you're going to go next, then you might ratchet up the aggressiveness of your investments a little bit more, get a little more hands-on with things, start to diversify your portfolio, and then make those big decisions in life.
That makes perfect sense.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm so excited for you. Send us an email
okay.
when your next step becomes clear. I want to know where you're going. I want to know what it is that's on the horizon for you, because I think it's fascinating and I think it's wonderful. Let us know where you put your money, because this is a great tip we can share with others, and let's see how it all plays out.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks so much.
I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Let's turn now to an email that I got just the other day. This one's from Richard, who wrote in from Natchitoches, Louisiana. I think I'm pronouncing that right. He says he's 23 years old and will be graduating with a master's degree in music education. He says he's confident about his job prospects, says he has no debt. Props to you, Richard. Says that because he'll be financially independent very soon, What is the best way for him to start building up credit now so that he'll be prepared down the road to rent an apartment, purchase a vehicle, or do other things that require credit? Richard, good questions, and I want to just give you a lot of respect for keeping your eye on the ball, thinking not just about right now, but also what's coming in the future. So important when it comes to money management, thinking not just one or two steps down the road, but let's say 10 or 12. That's the way a chess player wins games. That's the way a money manager wins games as well. So when you think about building up credit, what you want to think about is demonstrating to the world of finance that you are a fine, upstanding citizen. And a really quick way to do that is to start taking out some plastic, not too much, one, two cards maybe. Start using the plastic, start paying off the plastic, and demonstrate that you know how to handle debt, because that's what credit cards are. They loan you some money, you pay the money back. And there's going to be some people who say that it's wise to carry a balance in these situations to show the creditors of the world that you're not just a guy who pays off his debts, but can also manage debt on an ongoing basis. There might be something to that. I don't buy it. I personally believe that the best way to approach plastic, in other words, loans, in other words, debt, is to pay it off and to do so as effectively and efficiently as possible. So I would say use your plastic, pay off your bills, and do this month after month to demonstrate that you are a creditworthy individual. You might also think about being pre-approved for some loans. For example, pre-approval for a car loan, pre-approval even for a home loan. You might not be shopping for these big ticket things right now, but these pre-approvals also will register that you are a credit-worthy fellow, and that's the whole point of this exercise. And then when you finally need some actual credit, and that's what you say is coming down the road, you're going to be the guy they're all going to be lining up for outside your door saying, here, take some of our money. And that's where you want to be. So, Richard, thank you so much for that email. I appreciate that very much. Okay, we're going to take a quick break right here. When we come back, another one of your calls. To the calls, and this next one, well, this is a long distance call. This one's from William calling from London, England. Hi, William.
Hi, David. How are you?
Good. I got to say, in all the times I've done this show, no one's ever called me from London, England. What are you doing over there?
I am in the military and I'm stationed over here on exchange.
What is your role over there? What are you doing?
I'm working at the Ministry of Defense, and I'm an officer in the military, so I pretty much push papers and write emails. You know, that's how it goes.
That's what an officer does these days?
Unfortunately. When we're not deployed.
Well, what do you think of the posting there relative to other postings that you've had?
Well, there's nothing to complain about here as far as the posting goes. It's great to live in a somewhat different culture and get to see some different things along with taking your family with you. So I can't really complain about that.
I'm glad that you're safe and sound. I'm glad you're there with your family. Let's talk money. What's on your mind?
So my question is whether or not I need an investment manager, or whether that money that I am paying someone to manage my money for me is essentially kind of wasted. When you read everything that you read these days and about how you just statistically you can't beat the market, so you're better off investing in something that mirrors the market or tracks the market, would I just be better in kind of setting up my portfolio with a ratio of bonds to tracker funds that would suit my risk, my personality for risk, or my risk threshold, and then just let it go from there?
Just asking the right questions shows that you are on the right track. So first of all, give me a sense of your current finances. Are you in debt? Are you ahead of the game? Where are you at?
I think you would probably consider us well ahead of the game. So as you heard, I'm in the military 15 years. I'm married. We have one child. We won't have another. We don't have any significant debt other than a home mortgage. We're renting that house out. What the rent comes in pretty much covers the mortgage. We have about $500,000 socked away in various different types of retirement funds and investment funds. Most of that is unified under one investment manager. And then we have about roughly about $50,000 in cash split between checking and savings.
You know what I'm doing right now, William?
What's that?
I'm standing up and saluting because you have your house in order, and that is great. I just, you know, first of all, just want to say you got everything where it should be. So now we can zero in on your key question, and that is this investment manager who's charging, what, 1%, 1.5%?
1%.
Okay, 1%. But with your portfolio, that's like, what, $5,000 a year?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so that's a thing. That's some serious money now we're talking about. What kind of returns is this person bringing in?
So I'll admit that I am not a risky investor. So, you know, I had him place me in a somewhat more conservative investment with my major investments. And then kind of with our Roth IRAs, I had him do some a little bit more aggressive. But he gets between 8 and 10 over the last 2 years that I've had him.
All right. Let's keep in mind, historically speaking, the stock market returns approximately 8% a year.
Right.
Obviously, there's good years and bad years, but that's your historical average.
Right.
So this guy is not ahead of the curve.
Right.
You know, so let's say that. So you're paying $5,000 a year to basically keep pace with the market. And when you put it like that, this kind of suddenly starts becoming a no-brainer, doesn't it?
Right. Yeah. It kind of does.
Yeah. Now, I'm with you in the sense that it can be good to have an investment manager. And for those who are wary of making these decisions, having a pro help them with it or do it for them, that's fine. There is no right and wrong to this. But for somebody in your position who not just has managed his money well, but is also looking at how to maximize the money, I would say that you shouldn't be afraid of handing this guy his hat and taking the reins yourself on a trial basis and seeing how you do. And in that sense, one way to do it would be you shift your funds to a discount brokerage like, say, Fidelity or Schwab, and sit down with one of their investment professionals on a one-time-only basis. As you lay out your portfolio, you ask all the questions, you get all the answers, you adjudicate the risk threshold that you described before and apply that to these investments, and you lay out a portfolio that you're comfortable with, and then you sit back, let's say for about a year, and you watch how it does.
Okay.
And if you can't do better than 8%, well, then maybe you want to bring somebody back in who can do better. Otherwise, if you're doing at least 8%, well, you haven't lost anything, clearly, and you've now gained $5,000 a year that you otherwise would have been giving to some guy who wasn't doing anything much for you anyway.
Right.
What do you think? I mean, is that a plan you can live with?
No, it is. My follow-on question would have been, okay, so how do I go about doing it? So I think that is sage advice. You know, obviously, if I'm trying to get away from somebody that I'm paying full-time, the idea of sitting down with somebody one time and just paying them for their hours or their time right there and then, it kind of appeals to me since I'm not sure I could do it completely on my own.
Nor would I advise you to do it completely on your own, especially with a complex situation like yours, the military background, you got a family, you got kids. Obviously, you have enough moving parts in your life that you want somebody who really does this on a regular basis to hold your hand and get you through it. I would want it the same thing for myself. So that's okay. On the other hand, once you get it all in place, how much extra help do you need, especially for somebody like you who's got his eye on the ball anyway? Some of these brokerages will charge for the time of their investment professional. Some of them won't. And when you're picking a new home for your money, that might be a question to ask, is just lay it straight out for them. I'm going to want a little bit of help at the beginning to get my portfolio in shape, and then I'm going to sit back. Will you charge me for that person's time, or does that come with the service? And see what they say.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. I hadn't even thought of that, to be honest.
All right. And then once you get it all in place, don't forget, nothing is set in stone when it comes to your money. Don't be afraid to tweak things, to move things around. If something leaves your comfort zone, if something just doesn't smell right to you, if it seems a little too risky or not risky enough, everything can be fiddled with as you go along because you're in control.
Great. You make it sound so easy.
It's not, but it doesn't have to be so intimidating either. And the most important takeaway from something like this, and as a military guy, you know this, it's all about the plan.
Right.
If you got a good plan in place, you've got a way to move forward. And that's the same way it works with finances as well. Here's what I want you to do, William. After you decide what you do, send us an email. Let me know the decision you made, where you put your money, and how comfortable you are with your portfolio, and then let's keep an eye on it together, okay?
Okay, it sounds good. I appreciate your time.
I appreciate not just your call, but also your service. Thank you so much, sir.
All right, thank you. Goodbye.
Bye. As usual, some great questions, and if you've got a question, bring it on. You can reach us at marketplacemoney.org. Coming up, we'll be joined by Lizzie O'Leary for a sneak peek at the new show, Marketplace Weekend. But first, some do's and don'ts when it comes to being diligent about debt.
Make your goals a little smaller and a little bit easier and more accessible. And overall, the goal is going to be the same, you know, but making it smaller just helps you achieve it, celebrate your achievements a little faster, and then you work from that momentum. And I think that's why the debt snowball method is so popular.
That's just ahead on Marketplace Money from APM. Because it's summer doesn't mean that scammers are taking a vacation. And just because tax day is in the rearview mirror doesn't mean IRS-related scams are on hiatus. Let's talk about that. And here to help me out is Cameron Huddleston, who's a contributing editor at Kiplinger.com. Hiya, Cameron.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And I'm looking at an email that I and others at the LA Times received just this week. It looks like it's from the IRS. It says, "Sincerely, Jennifer Green, IRS Public Relations," at the bottom. And at the top, it says, "Our records indicate that you are a non-resident." Hello, not true. "And that you are exempted from the United States of America tax reporting and withholdings on interest paid to you on your account, blah, blah, blah. Therefore, you are required to authenticate the following by completing form W-8-B-E-N, attached and returned to us as soon as possible." And then when I took a look at the W-8-BEN form here, looks really official until I compared it with a real W-8-BEN form, and it turned out to be completely bogus. It wanted far more information than the normal IRS form would normally ask for. And then down at the bottom, the real sneaky thing, "Scan and send back via email to IRSUSA2014@yandex.com. Hello, red flags all over the field. First question, who falls for this?
Obviously, there are people who do, and a lot of them might be immigrants, as you suggested. It was sent to you, you know, talking about non-resident status and forms that you had to fill out as a non-resident. So people who aren't familiar with the way it works, aren't familiar with these forms, don't realize that it's irs.gov, not irsusa.com. And perhaps a lot of times the elderly are targeted too, people who just aren't savvy to this type of thing, don't recognize those red flags that you mentioned.
So in a situation like this, they're sending out millions of these spammy emails, and they're just gambling that it's going to get through to, let's say, thousands of people who might actually mistake it for the real deal. And every one of those people who coughs up their Social Security number, their bank account number, their spouse's Social Security number, that's just pure gravy.
Sure, they can steal their ID, you know, create new passports, new license that can give to other people and use it and ruin someone's credit, you know, rack up bills in their name, get people in all sorts of trouble.
You know, every one of us gets this stuff, and we always look at it and think, God, who falls for this? But obviously enough people do to make it worthwhile for scammers. So let's talk about not just the IRS scams, but all of them, the phishing scams, all of them. How does an internet user, an average internet user, spot this stuff?
Well, back to the IRS scams, the IRS does not send emails to taxpayers. So if you get any sort of email claiming to be from the IRS, that's your red flag right there. The IRS communicates to taxpayers by mail. It also does not call taxpayers. I was actually targeted by scammers by phone just a couple days ago. And it was ironic because it was a scam that I had written about for Kiplinger's. I get the call and the person on the other end of the line says, this is the IRS and we're investigating you. And suddenly I felt panic. You know, anytime you hear IRS and investigation, you think, well, my gosh, what have I done? And then as the person continued to talk, I thought, wait a second, this is that scam. This is the scam that I wrote about. And really the way the scam works is people will call up and they'll say that you owe money and you're going to be arrested if you don't pay. They want you to pay by a prepaid debit card or a wire transfer. And that's a huge red flag. Anytime anyone, whether it's an IRS scam or any sort of scam, uses the words wire transfer, you know that that's not legitimate.
So let's talk about how you spot this stuff. Obviously, some of the common sense things we've been discussing, you look for the .gov domain name or other such, you know, obvious things. But what else can people do, such as hovering their cursor over the actual URL? Will that help?
It does help. If you see a URL in an email, like you said, hover your cursor over it. And a lot of times it'll show you what the actual one is. But you don't want to click on any link in an email, an unsolicited email. If perhaps it's claiming to be from a company, go to that company's website, look up the phone number, call the company directly if it's claiming you've won some sort of prize. But, you know, any sort of unsolicited email you get that claims that you've won a prize, and if you know you haven't entered in any sort of sweepstakes, any sort of competition, just delete it. You really just have to be a smart consumer, a smart taxpayer, a smart user of email, and realize that a lot of what's going to come through is going to be junk. And you should hit the delete button. Don't be tempted to open it, especially, you know, if you're clicking on a link, it's going to take you to a fraudulent site, or it might download a virus onto your computer. Anytime you get a phone call and it's someone claiming to be from a government agency, hang up. Go to that government agency's website, if it's the IRS, irs.gov, get the phone number and call directly and say, hey, are you trying to contact me? Is there a problem, you know, for example, with my tax form?
Hey, great news, Cameron. I just found out you won the Marketplace Sweepstakes.
Oh, yay. What do I get?
Well, first you got to send the money to me and then we'll work that out afterwards.
No, thank you.
Cameron Huddleston is a contributing editor at Kiplinger.com. Cameron, thanks for all that great advice.
You're welcome.
Regular listeners know that I'm not a big fan of debt, and that's because getting yourself out of the hole can be hard. On the other hand, if it were easy, we wouldn't have so much to talk about, would we? So, what can you do when you're in the debt danger zone? Let's put that question to Kristen Wong. She's a personal finance writer with the life hacker blog, 2 Cents. Welcome, Kristen.
Hi, thank you.
Are you in debt?
I am not, but I was in debt.
From what?
Student loans, mainly. Mm. And a little bit of consumer, like credit card debt, too.
And student loans are hard, because even if you file bankruptcy, they're still there.
They're still there. They're always there. You have to pay them off. You can't just ignore them, yeah.
Okay, so we've all been down that road, more or less. I mean, whether it's credit cards, mortgage, other things, debt just piles up. What do you do when you're not seeing that pile going down?
It's easy to get discouraged with your goals when they seem so insurmountable and that pile doesn't look like it's dwindling at all. And one way to do it, one simple way to do it, is to just set some smaller milestones for yourself. So make your goals a little bit easier, a little bit more accessible. So instead of saying, let's say you have $5,000 worth of debt that you want to pay off for the year. So instead of saying, well, my goal this year is to pay off $5,000 worth of debt, you might say, well, it's my goal to pay off $500 or $400 worth of debt this month. So you just make your goals a little smaller and a little bit easier and more accessible. And overall, the goal is going to be the same, you know, but making it smaller just helps you achieve it, celebrate your achievements a little faster, and then you work from that momentum. And I think that's why the debt snowball method is so popular and why that works so well and it's so effective, is because you pay off your smaller debts first and you see progress being made. And as you see progress being made, you want to keep going. And overall, that works better. Instead of like giving into the discouragement of your money goals, not being able to reach them, you say, no, I can do this. And so you want to keep going, and eventually you get there.
That's more like keeping your eye on the short game as opposed to the long game.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's, you know, overall, it's going to be the same. You're going to get to the same place, but it's just making sure that you keep doing it and you don't stop yourself. Because when something seems so overwhelming, it's easy to just give up on it. But when you make those smaller achievements and you see yourself making progress, then it makes it easier to tackle that.
We hear from a lot of people during the listener call segment talking about how hard it can be just to get your hands around your money, to just start dealing with your money situation. Yet I know from personal experience and from talking to others, once you do that, once you start making inroads towards money management, the rest of it kind of falls into place.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just getting in control of your finances and feeling like you're in control. Even if you're in debt, you can still feel like you're in control. Like when I started paying down my student loan debt and I saw progress being made, somehow I put two and two together and I was like, wow, I'm doing this. I'm making this happen. And that made me feel like, even though I was in debt, it made me feel like I'm owning this. I'm in control of this. I'm making things happen and I'm doing it. I'm in control. My money is not in control of me. So I think a lot of it is just switching to that mindset.
You've written about something called trigger temptations, where you're basically enabling yourself to have bad habits. All right, what does that mean and how do you deal with that?
Well, I think a lot of people, as we mentioned, a lot of people get discouraged with their money goals because their goals are just so huge. But I think another reason people get discouraged with their money goals is because they're just spendy. I'm spendy. I like to spend. And it's gotten in the way of my goals before. So one thing I wrote about was just kind of if you're an impulsive shopper, there are things you can do to kind of get back on track with your goals. And there are things you can do to kind of automate your success, for lack of a better phrase, and just make sure that you don't, to kind of protect yourself from yourself, if that makes sense. For example, don't store your credit card information online. If you have Google Wallet or something like that where your credit card information is automatically stored and you go to a website where you like to spend money, it's just so easy to just automatically, you know, click pay now and your credit card information is all there. When you have to take that extra step of putting in your credit card information, it gives you another moment to second guess yourself and think, oh, right, I have goals. Maybe I shouldn't be doing this.
Oh, I totally have that problem with Amazon, which has it stored in, and I'll easily buy books that I might have otherwise reconsidered. Are you saying then that if I didn't have all that stuff stored with Amazon, I might not be buying all those ebooks as quickly as I do?
You might not. And it definitely worked for me. I didn't have my credit card information stored for a while. And I think it was PayPal. And I had PayPal linked to so many different things that when I would buy something, it was like, pay with PayPal. Oh, yeah, definitely do that. But unlinking that prevented me. It made me think, well, I have to get up and get my credit card and I have to enter in the information. And if you have a spending problem and you're trying to save up your goals and the only thing that's stopping you is you're too lazy to go get up and get your credit card, then you probably don't need to be spending the money anyway. You know what I mean? So it's just one thing you can do to kind of prevent yourself from spending money that you don't need to spend. Another thing is you might consider blocking the websites that cause you problems.
Oh, get out. Who would do that?
I haven't had to go that far, but I can see how that would be a good idea for me. We like to shop. We're consumers. And the internet makes it so easy to do that. So I think a lot of people have impulsive spending problems and they think that, I mean, I've been there, so I can definitely relate. But I think they think it's easy. Well, just mind over matter, but it's not really that easy. Protecting yourself from yourself and your own spending, I think, is important. And there are ways you can do that automatically.
And e-commerce sites across the country right now are saying, Kristen, what? Stop!
No, shut up!
Kristen Wong is a personal finance writer with the Lifehacker blog, 2 Cents. Thanks so much for joining us, Kristen.
Thank you for having me.
the last installment of Marketplace Money, but Marketplace Weekend is coming at us like a freight train. And to tell us more about it, Lizzie O'Leary, the host of the show. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, David. I've always wanted to be described as a freight train.
Well, who wouldn't? And yeah. I'm looking forward to Marketplace Weekend. What can we expect?
So this is a different kind of show. Still in the Marketplace family, but I think a slightly different exploration of the way money intersects with everybody's life. And I mean that kind of in the broadest ways, right? So a great big news story and then the how and the why behind it. What's the fabric of that? Where does that impact your life, your family, your kids? All of that stuff, we are going to put human stories into an economic context and economic stories into a human context.
I imagine there's going to be a lot of interactivity. The social media component will be high.
It's going to be very high. And that's a really big thing for us. Look, the show does not start when I start talking into a microphone. It doesn't end when I stop talking into a microphone. So on our website, marketplaceweekend.org, there are going to be conversations about kind of the big issues of the day. And what we're going to do is actually pull out some of those and bring those people onto the radio to talk to us and illuminate a little bit more about kind of what's going on.
And can I find you through Facebook? Can I find you through Twitter?
Yeah, totally. I'm on that stuff all the time. And that's sort of, I think, a big part of the DNA of this show. When you go to marketplaceweekend.org, we're going to guide you through all of this stuff, and we're going to do it on the other sites, and we're going to look forward, too. This isn't just about kind of what happened in the past week, but where it goes next, and then kind of what that means.
So I know the first show is still a week away, but do you know what we're going to hear?
Well, on one thing I do, and it's actually one where listeners can hop online now and contribute to it, it's a conversation about what we're calling the gray economy. So things you maybe did to get by that were outside of the lines, maybe legal, but for example, our producer, when he was starting out, you know, public radio, he was a young guy, wasn't entirely paying the bills. It turns out he's an amazing poker player. And that was the thing that got him through paying the rent, picking up the groceries, stuff like that. We are collecting and curating stories like that about other stuff that people did and are doing when whatever you're doing on the up and up isn't entirely getting you through the week or the month.
And one thing I've noticed as you've been putting all of this effort into getting the show off the ground is that it seems to share the same chromosomes and DNA with the other Marketplace programs.
Absolutely. That, I think, is incredibly important to us. You're going to hear familiar voices. You're going to hear people from Marketplace, reporters whose names you know and love. And in fact, the stories you really liked a lot on Marketplace, if you like them on our website, that can actually drive those reporters onto the air. So, hey, you like something that Chrissy Clark or Sabri Benishore did? Great. That means you can say, good, bring them on to Marketplace Weekend. I want to hear more about what happened behind that story. How did you get that? What was underneath that? What's left in your notebook? And what are you working on next?
So it always sounds like there's going to be a way. I'm going to get the headlines in the morning. I'm going to get the depth in the afternoon. And then on the weekend, you're going to bring it all together.
Yeah, you're going to get the why. You're going to get the why behind it and the what's next.
Oh, that sounds great. I'm really excited about it. I want to say thank you for letting me sit in the big seat for the past few weeks because it's been a lot of fun. But look, Lizzie, since you're here, why don't you put Marketplace Money to bed?
All right. Thank you. I'm going to take the wheel. David Lazarus, thank you for all of this.
Thank you.
All right, that's it. That's Marketplace Money. Coming up next week on Marketplace Weekend, what does the middle class look like to you?
White picket fence, two cars, all that. Yeah, but I don't believe in it, so.
So what's happening? Americans can still see that picture, but wonder where we fit in it. We find out why. Then there are the space tourists of New Mexico. Except $200 million later, they're still not flying.
People who come on the ground to just check out what the other space tourists are doing.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Next week, come meet our new show, Marketplace Weekend. We'll explore real-life financial news while getting you ready for what's next. And hey, it's the weekend, so we might even have brunch. See you then. Marketplace Money is produced by Candice Manriquez and Caitlin Fenaro. And congrats to Caitlin on a new addition to her family. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. And remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. This is APM.